Hi, this is Mike McNamara, and you're listening to All Marine Radio on your home for it, the one and only All Warrior Radio Network. Right after I started doing All Marine Radio, which is, we're into our fifth year now, as unbelievable as that is, I got pointed in the direction of a guy named Jack Hovan. And it had to do with martial arts training in the Marine Corps and then the evolution of that into this concept of, ethical warrior. That runs throughout the Marine Corps martial arts program, and then transitioning that to the civilian world and this concept of ethical guardian. And so in watching the news the last couple of weeks, you see these terms being used now. And I want to say it was two nights ago, somebody used that specific term, right? And that was ethical guardian. And I thought, whoa, she read Jack's stuff. So rejoining me again is Jack Hovan. So, Jack, first of all, welcome back to All Marine Radio.
Well, thank you. Thank you, Mac. It's a pleasure.
Now, first of all, we got to do a little bit of a thumbnail for those that have never didn't hear the first interview. Born and raised where?
I was born in Florida but raised in New Jersey.
What part of New Jersey? Southern New Jersey, Northern New Jersey? It makes a difference.
Well, I was grew up in Northern New Jersey until I was about 17, but now for the last 30 years I live at the Jersey Shore, a place called Seagirt, and it's a beautiful day here.
Jack was first on the show in 2017. And talking about these kind of issues, how do you find your way to the Marine Corps, Jack?
Well, I went to Villanova University, and I was a so-so student. Didn't have a lot of direction. My dad challenged me. He said, "Every Marine I ever met, I had a lot of respect for. Bet you can't make it in the Marines." So to prove him wrong, I applied to become a Marine officer. In fact, I just talked to my OSO yesterday. We're still friends.
Wow.
And he said he was scraping the bottom of the barrel. It was right after
end of the month
after Vietnam.
Yeah, right at the end of the month, scraping the barrel. How funny. How funny.
So I graduated from Villanova. And went to the basic school, and I didn't really have a lot of mentorship. I really didn't know what the best career path should have been. I probably would have done things differently if I had. But combat engineer sounded really cool. I mean, you could do all the infantry stuff, but you could also blow things up. So
why not?
I put in to be a combat engineer, and then went down to Courthouse Bay. And then to Okinawa, where I was a platoon commander and an XO and even briefly a CO. And then I came back to San Diego, and I was a series commander there for five series. And over the course of this time, I had a hobby. It was martial arts. I really liked martial arts a lot. And I'd seen different martial arts of Korea and Japan, of course, and Okinawa. Also Philippines. So I finagled myself an ancillary duty in San Diego of being kind of the martial arts guy, and had a class and taught people on the base. I actually had a class on the base, and got a little bit of a reputation of just having a lot of interest in it. Not that I was anything special, but in 1996, after I had already been out and kind of on reserve duty, the Marine Corps had stood up a combat close combat review board to review how Marines were going to be taught close quarter combat in the new world of UPMA or low intensity conflict or what we call now counterinsurgency. And I was invited to Quantico to be on that board. And it was kind of a funny situation because you had all kinds of people there. I mean, you had anybody that thought they were interested in martial arts finagled their way onto this review board. So we had about 20 or 30 people. And you're not going to believe this, Mac, but we did not all agree on exactly where the way forward was. And to oversimplify, it a little bit broke down into two groups. Group number one said, you know, the mission of this board is to scour the world for the meanest, baddest, hurtinest, killingest martial arts techniques and bring them into the Marine Corps and teach them. And, you know, we were all pretty much on the same page as we wanted the program to be realistic and tough. But then there was another group on the other side that says, well, wait a minute, you know, based upon our experience, we know that if you teach people all these horrible techniques and you don't have a character piece to it, you're asking for trouble. You know, these guys are going to go out, have one, maybe 10 beers and out in town and, you know, want to try these things out or even worse, go overseas and use them improperly, irresponsibly, unethically, and undermine, you know, win the hearts and minds efforts that are part of counterinsurgency. So we really have to have a character piece. And I kind of stood up for that. And somebody says, okay, great, Hoban, you can be the ethics guy. And I was like, well, wait a minute. I don't want to be the ethics guy. I actually wanted to be – I thought I was more qualified to be the bayoneting guy, frankly. But, you know, that's kind of – and I got painted with that brush and, you know, we fooled around for 4 years. And then finally in 2000, the General Jones at that time said, okay, enough. We're going to kick this thing off. He put George Bristol in charge and Bristol called me in to say, listen, you know, we liked the piece about the ethics. And by that time I started kind of nicknaming it the ethical warrior piece so that we had the warrior piece and we also had the character piece. And I've been the SME of McMap ever since then, you know, through five now different directors, including Kevin Nally and Joe Shusko. And now we have a new fellow over there. He's a major. His name is Chet Carter. So they're following through on the three pieces of the puzzle, which are the, you know, the physical, the mental, and the character for the McMac program. And that's kind of where we are now.
All right, I'm going to give you 60 seconds to talk about Robert Humphrey because his son is a good friend of mine and he had a huge impact on your life. And, you know, and you know, and he used boxing to teach respect and was foundational to the things he taught. You crossed paths with him in San Diego. Give everybody 60 seconds on Robert Humphrey and how his impact on you and ultimately on this program.
Yeah. Well, I got off the drill field and after about five or six series. And since I was a combat engineer, they made me the facilities engineer. I don't know what fixing toilet bowls has to do with blowing up bridges, but or clearing IEDs, but so I go to, I just said, you know, instead of going out drinking every night, I should probably use my benefits and get a degree. So I went to get an MBA, and he was one of the professors. He taught cross-cultural conflict resolution in business. And at first, I thought he was kind of like a, you know, old fuddy-duddy professor type, you know, with the, you know, the smile and the tweed jacket and the elbow patches, but I soon learned that I had him all wrong. He had been a rifle platoon commander on Iwo Jima. He was a Marine's Marine. He was the confidant of several commandants. And he really took a guy that was a hammer looking for a nail, you know, and focused me on taking my martial arts skills and making sure that they were always done as an ethical warrior, as a protector. And, you know, you either got to read his book or give me more than a minute. But I would say that he was the greatest mentor that a young Marine could ever have. And I still talked him up in heaven, you know, as recently as this weekend over some things that I'm going through and asking his advice. Just a great, great Marine, a great, great American, and probably one of the greatest natural law philosophers that we have in this country. Too bad he's not better known, but hopefully he's a little better known now. Robert L. Humphrey, read his book, Values for a New Millennium.
Values for a New Millennium. It's awesome. Talk to me now, and I'm sorry to limit you on that, but I want to get to the substance because, you know, the area that you've gone down, the whole nation's looking at now, and so I want to spend some time on it. How does this get into law enforcement? Explain that migration. So you've done all this work in Marine Corps martial arts. Does a door open? How does this get migrated to the law enforcement community? And then how does it change as it goes to the law enforcement community?
So I'm going to oversimplify this a little bit, but the coincidence was that the TBS, where the Marine Corps Martial Arts Program resides at Raider Hall at the Martial Arts Center of Excellence, shares a base with, as you know, the FBI.
Right.
Well, after 9/11, and again, I'm sure I'm oversimplifying this, but after 9/11 in Baghdad, you know, people realized that the police department of Baghdad was all Sunnis. So they didn't trust them, and they pretty much disbanded it, from what I understood. And now we have a war going on and also a crime wave, because in a city that size, beside, you know, the political and military issues, there's criminals. And Marines ended up being, you know, de facto chiefs of police and mayors and everything else. And you know this. Eventually, people realized that, you know, we needed a new police department. In fact, one of the guys that stood that up is a very close friend of mine named Mike Olivier, Colonel Mike Olivier. And they were going to send FBI agents over there to help them reestablish an investigative piece to the police department. They didn't have that much experience in overseas type of things like that in a war zone. So a guy that I knew who was an FBI senior guy says, you know, Jack, you know, you've been talking about this and work with Dr. Humphrey on this win the hearts and minds type of things for a long time. Would you brief us at the FBI on kind of cross-cultural conflict resolution and how to work with people overseas in this kind of environment? So I figured, okay, you know, whatever. I go over to the J. Edgar Hoover building or whatever it is in Washington, D.C., and I figure I'm going to sit down and give a little brief or something. They put me on a stage with a camera and an audience, and they simulcast my basic cross-cultural conflict resolution brief to the entire FBI world, and becomes their kind of training video for how to deal cross-culturally in these kind of conflict situations. And afterwards, you know, the guy that was the kind of brought me in, his name was Bruce Gorley. He's retired now. He ended up being the ASAC of New York City. Big job. Now he works in a big healthcare system as the security chief. He says, you know, you really ought to take this and fashion it for law enforcement. I mean, what you're talking about is basically community policing. I mean, look at our, you know, biggest cities. I mean, they have crime, they have violence, they have cross-cultural issues. Why don't you do that? And I said, well, I'm not a police officer. He says, well, you know police officers, why don't you get together with them? And so I asked this guy, Bruce Gorley, and then a number of other folks. There was a U.S. Marshal. There was a couple of NYPD guys, Jersey State Police. And we all sat down, and I told them, you know, what I had learned from Humphrey and what I had talked about in with the Marines. And we put together a program and we tested it. We just made it up and we tested it. And I talked to the sheriff here in New Jersey in Monmouth County, and he sent some guys, and some of the police department sent some guys in it. It went off really well. And the New Jersey State Police folks started to snoop around it. And one of the retired lieutenants there, his name is Frank Rogers, he had started a consulting company to help, police departments do best practices and things like that. And he was having a symposium at Stockton University here in New Jersey about ethics in policing. So he asked me if I would be the keynote speaker. So I went down there and I gave a speech to about 300-400 police leaders. And I'd written a book called The Ethical Warrior, so I figured, you know, maybe I could sell some books. I'll give a free speech, you know. And actually sold all the books. And
nice.
At the end of it, this guy comes up to me. He says, hi, my name is Scott Thompson. I am the new chief of Camden Police Department. It was changed. Actually, the Camden Police Department was just reformed as a Camden County Police Department. And he says, I'm looking for ideas. I mean, we have per capita the most dangerous city in America. We're not the biggest, but per capita, we're the most dangerous. And what I heard today, I really am interested. I've never heard anything like that before. I said, okay, great. Well, here's my card. And I forgot all about it, you know, because people say stuff all the time. Out of the blue, several months later, I get a call from Camden County Police Department. Can you come in and talk to us? So I go in. I meet with the chief. He says, how would you train our whole police department in – we were calling it the ethical protector then, because the FBI didn't like the word warrior. So we changed it to ethical protector for law enforcement. How would you – teach our whole department how to be ethical protectors. So I put together a plan, and the plan is, you know, I actually wrote an article about it and I sent it to you. That's how we did it. I said, okay, give me your 20 best guys, and I don't care what their rank is. I don't, you know, I want the 20 guys that people in the department look up to, the young guys look up to. Well, the first thing he did was give me his best, I think he was a sergeant at the time. His name is Kevin Lutz. And he was a former Marine wrestler. So he figured out that, you know, this guy wrestles and he's a great cop. He was a great street cop. Now he's running the training for the department. So he and I, Kevin Lutz and I, got together and he says, okay, I want you to mentor Lutz and you guys figure this out. Well, the first thing I did was I took him down to Quantico and showed him what we do at the Marine Corps Martial Arts Program. I made him go through a few days, and he went through the Quigley Special, the whole nine yards. He, crawling in the mud. I got pictures of it. It's great. And he came, and you know, he was a kind of a big shot wrestler. So he didn't really do much Marine stuff. He was an MP, but as soon as they found that he could wrestled at the level he could, he'd spent almost an entire 3-year Marine Corps career wrestling. So he had barely been out in the field and done the kind of stuff that we were doing, you know, fighting in the woods. And at the end, he said, I did more Marine stuff in the last 3 days than I did in my whole 3-year career. And he was all fired up, you know. So I kind of had him, right?
All right.
So we went back and we picked the 19 more of the best folks, and they came in all flavors, you know, male, female, all different ethnic groups. Some were lieutenants or sergeants or, you know, leaders. Some were just patrol guys. We picked guys that had combat experience, that had done counterinsurgency. We picked people that were dog handlers. We picked people that the other guys just respected and looked up to, regardless of rank. It was very unique. And then we did two things at the same time. I trained those 20 folks in intensive training for several months. In the meantime, I was doing a one-hour brief port starboard for the rest of the other 400 or 500 officers to just introduce them to what it was all about and what was going to happen. Once everybody had been given the orientation, and once I had the mentors trained, we took the officers 25 at a time, and sometimes we let other neighboring police departments send guys too, but 25 at a time, my staff, made up of former cops and one Marine, and some of the mentors, not all of them at the same time, and we trained the other 400 people, 25 people at a time, for months and months and months. In the meantime, we did sustainment with the mentors because it was very stressful. People were leaving. They didn't get paid a lot of money. It was really dangerous. And they had a lot of complaints. So we would listen to the complaints, and then we would just do sustainment. And the sustainment consisted of three things. One, we would continually activate our feeling as a protector. Because in law enforcement, from my perspective anyway, I've never been a law enforcement officer, but I've spent a lot of time around them now. There's kind of two competing self-concepts. One self-concept is that of an enforcer. You know, you enforce the law, and you have to be fair and firm about it. And certainly that's a part of the job. The other self-concept, however, is that of a protector. And sometimes these two things get mixed up of what is your true self-concept. Are you a protector that enforces, or you are an enforcer that, you know, well, you're supposed to be protecting people too. And that self-concept is a lot fuzzier in my experience, and I've done thousands of these police officers now, than you would hope. And one of the first things we have to do is clarify the self-concept of a police officer as a protector who enforces rather than the other way around. The second piece was we had to teach de-escalation skills. People under stress don't always say the right thing. I'm married, you're married. You know, we don't always say the thing that's going to de-escalate a conflict. Sometimes we say things that make it worse. And police officers are under stress. And unless they know what to say or really good at it, they often can make things worse by the way they talk to people or what they say, even if they don't mean to. And sometimes they do mean to. So we had to use a technology that was tested that we knew worked verbal de-escalation. And the technology we used is verbal defense and influence, which is kind of the grandson of the old verbal judo de-escalation that people may have heard of from back in the 70s if you were a cop. It's much more refined now. VDI, they call it, verbal defense and influence. And it's scripts. If this happens, you say this first, then you say that second, you say that third. And the research shows over the course of years and years that if you say it this way, it de-escalates better than if you skip a step or if you just wing it. So we're dealing with a lot of young police officers who are not that good at talking. They're good at texting. They're good at, you know, writing on Instagram. But when you have to walk up to a drug dealer on a street corner in downtown Camden and make conversation with them, maybe even confront them, they don't know what to say. They didn't know what to say. So we had to say, okay, say this first, say the second, introduce yourself, tell them why you stopped them. And we had to memorize the script. My name is Officer Jones. The reason I stopped by today is because I wanted to tell you about a new program we have, this Ethical Protector Program, Guardian Program. And I'm going to be walking the beat here. We're going to be out and more visible. So I just wanted to introduce myself. How you doing? And believe it or not, we had to have people memorize that line so they could act. It's not it's not easy to walk up to some of these tough-looking guys and just start a conversation and tell them that you want to be their protector all of a sudden. I mean, so the verbal skills, the de-escalation skills, I can't go through the whole methodology now, but I could if you at a different time, or you can research it, verbal defense and influence. The third piece was the physical piece. If you're going to be a protector, the first blush feeling is, well, you know, that sounds a little softer than enforcer. And I had the exact same problem with the Marines. You know, when I wanted to say to Marines, we're going to be ethical warriors, ethical protectors, not killer devil dogs, the Marines are looking at me and saying, well, the nice ones would say, are you sure that's safe, Jack? The other ones would say, this is you know what, right?
This is bullshit, right? Yeah, who is this guy and when are we done?
Yeah, what is this crap, you know? Right, and right. So I had to do a couple of things. I had to, first of all, when I would teach the Marines, before I even got into the ethical piece, I would say, well, let me see your technique. And they try technique on each other. And, you know, they'd been training for 7 weeks at the MAIT program, at the instructor training program. So they were pretty good at the techniques. And then I would say something like, all right, do it again. And then I'd say to the, you know, to his training partner, says, don't let him do it. And invariably, it would turn into a big wrestling match, you know, standoff. They couldn't do it against a resisting opponent who knew the technique. So then I'd walk over and I said, okay, do it to me. And they do it to me. And, well, you know, they've been doing it for 7 weeks. I've been doing it for 40 years, okay? Right. So I could probably do the technique on the guy even if he was resisting. And once I did that, since I was also like 35 years older than them, they would go, oh, okay. And then they would start, then they would maybe listen to what I had to say. But I would always get to that bridge where I had to prove to them that being a protector would not put them at a tactical disadvantage. Because if they felt that being an ethical warrior, an ethical protector, was going to put them at a tactical disadvantage, you know, we weren't going to be able to sell this thing, right? Because nobody, the last thing I wanted to do, and I agonized over this, the last thing I wanted to do was make Marines so quote-unquote ethical that now they would hesitate or they wouldn't be as tactically proficient or tactically prepared if it went south, because it can often go south with Marines, but also police officers. So I thought about it, and I thought about it, and I thought about it, and I probably told you the story already. What I did was I'd finally get the Marines on the ground. We'd been fighting. We're all sweaty and everything like that. We kind of bonded. And I'd say, all right, I got a story for you. I got a tie-in. Okay, Marines, you're walking through a forest. You see a grizzly bear. Are you afraid? And they'd all like roll their eyes at me and go, well, yeah, of course I would be afraid. Predator, grizzly, you know, killer grizzly. I said, okay, fair enough. Okay, now you're walking through a forest. Would you, and you see a grizzly bear with two cubs. Would you be more afraid or less afraid? And they would all look at me like, what are you kidding? I'd be more afraid. And I go, why? I go, because she's going to protect the cubs. I said, what? They said, well, she's going to protect. I said, what? And then they'd start smiling. And they said, because she was going to be a protector. So I would say, oh, so you're saying that protectors are more dangerous than killers? And then I had them. Because it's true, isn't it? Even in nature, protectors are more dangerous than killers. What's our oath? To protect and defend. And I do solemnly swear to go kill people. I do solemnly swear to go protect and defend. I mean, so once we were able to clarify that, both with the Marines but also the police officers, we could get them to believe that being an ethical protector, ethical warrior, was actually more tactical and safer for everyone as long as you had physical self-confidence and you had the martial arts skills. So then we could get into the martial arts skills, but people would have a whole different mindset about why they were doing it. And then the final piece of that would be, I talked with you know, Bill Nash, who you may know, who spent a lot of time with the Marine Corps as with, you know, mental health issues and PTSD. And we know from the research that the mindset, the self-concept of being a protector, an ethical warrior, is way more psychologically healthy than that of being a, you know, so-called self-styled enforcer or killer. It's just more psychologically healthy, and we've proved that it's not any less tactical, maybe more tactical. And we kind of got them, both the Marines and the law enforcement guys, with the same argument.
All right, now I got like 15 questions I want to ask you, but I want so we've seen this discussion about defunding the police. This gets put to work in Camden, right, where they had issues with the police department, and they essentially recreated their police force. And you're essentially in the middle of that. How does tell everybody how that turns out?
Well, it turns out there's a lot of results. First of all, the plan is not to have the Jack Hoban Police Department or the RGI. My company is called Resolution Group International, RGI. The end state is for us to, you know, set this stage, help them reboot their culture, and then for them to take it from there. So that's what has happened over the years. Their program is their program now. Their culture is their culture now. And so, you know, I've kind of faded out of the limelight. Now, I still have a lot of personal relations with them. Kevin Lutz, who I talked about, was at my house sitting 6 feet away from me this past weekend because he just, you know, there's so much in the news about Camden. He just wanted to come in and ask my opinion on some things, how to answer some questions. He just wanted to talk about it.
Right.
And but whether I will ever be formally asked back to do follow-on training with Camden, maybe not. Maybe. You never know. Things change. They may run into something and they want another opinion.
Did it have what was the impact it had on the police force and policing in the community? Were the trend lines mixed? Because there's a spectrum of things that police do. Tell us about that. Was it positively received by both law enforcement and the community? What was the initial reaction to it after you had finished your piece?
Well, the initial reaction was they became famous because it was the crime went down so fast, and the community relations went up so fast, even with people who were really skeptical. I mean, you can go back and read the old news reports, but people were cautiously optimistic, but they couldn't believe how fast it happened. So, of course, Rolling Stone, New York Times, all these people came down and started interviewing us and interviewing me. How did you do it? And I said, people are natural protectors. You just have to activate it, and they need three things. They need to clarify their self-concept. They need to be able to learn tried and true de-escalation techniques, and they need physical self-confidence and tactical skills. If you do that from the top down, you can reboot the culture, and you can look at the crime statistics. They're half of what they were back those days. And that's why, you know, there's such a resurgence in interest in Camden in particular, because they are seen as the gold standard of, you know, how do you turn a police department around and create a good community policing atmosphere? And by the way, the chief there now is not even the chief that brought me in. He's the next chief. Well, that guy, Joe Wasaki, he is a cop's cop. He just embodies the culture that we were talking about. In fact, he, as a senior man, was out on the beach with me doing push-up contests with the guys. I mean, this doesn't happen anymore, that a chief would go out and train in the sand doing push-ups with the guys and running in the sand and going through all the same training that they did. One of the things that doesn't work and that I've seen happen a lot is people hear about our program and the changes that we're able to inspire, and they send, you know, three of their guys that are having trouble, right? This guy's a lot of complaints or whatever it is. So they send them to our course. You know, we reboot them for 3 days, and, you know, in more than 90% of the cases, we turn them around and they go out. They come in all surly and pissed off that they have to go to training, and then they leave 3 days later. Oh my gosh, I remember why I wanted to be a cop in the first place. Holy crap. But then if you go back to the same quote unquote enforcement mentality where leaders sit in their offices and don't lead from the front, how long do you think that that's going to last before it wears off? So that kind of thing, you know, sending a guy to a 3-day program is not going to turn this thing around this country. You have to have top-down support and top-down participation. Let me tell you about another department.
Hold, let me ask you I want to ask you one question.
Sure.
One of the things that's been common in the things that we've seen, if you look at the arrest of Eric Gardner, if you look at the arrest of the detainment of Mr. Floyd and Mr. Brooks here most recently, they're all failed efforts to subdue a suspect, which lead to an escalation. And I've gone through the Washington Post database for 2019, 2018. And if I could tell you that there is a for people that are, quote unquote, unarmed, some of them are trying to kill cops with cars and things like that. So I don't think it's technically the appropriate categorization. But for those that aren't trying to kill with cops, it is the same narrative. It is a detainment that goes wrong. The suspect resists. The police officers, officer or officers don't handle it well, don't physically handle it well. And then there's a person dead. Looking at the Floyd detainment, right, there's four police officers there, and for some reason they cannot get him into a police vehicle, and he's dead. The other night, there's two police officers that cannot subdue a suspect. One loses their weapon. So to me, you know, in listening to you, you know, you discussed and the physical confidence, right, to be a protector. It seems like in those cases, those are glaring shortfalls, the physical confidence to subdue a suspect when there's multiple police officers and a single suspect. Could you comment on your thoughts as you watch those attempted detainments? Do you put your head in your hands and go, good God, we could be so much better than this?
Well, you know, there are people that are really hard to detain, okay,
right.
Really hard. And, you know, that said, most police officers that I've worked with are not skilled at basic takedowns and submissions. They're just not skilled at it because they don't practice it, and they whatever they were taught in the academy is not used often enough. So I, as a Marine, felt that I needed those skills. But you know what? There's a whole bunch of Marines, United States Marines, that are afraid of or poo-poo the need to do McMap. I just don't understand that. I mean, if you're a Marine, why wouldn't you want to know how to do hand-to-hand combat? Now, there's also the other extreme. This is, well, you know, McMap is kind of a vanilla program compared to Brazilian jiu-jitsu or tic-tac-toe or something like that. Well, you know, actually in McMap, we encourage people to cross-train in other martial arts and learn as much as they possibly can. But if you're proficient in the tan belt McMap program, you are better than 90% of the people that you're going to encounter. No question about it. You just have to be proficient in it. And it's the same thing with police officers. You know, they're not basically proficient in you know, simple takedowns and submissions. And a part of that is their fault. And a part of that is, you know, the focus on, you know, the online training and, you know, the required training that seems to eat up all of their training time.
All their limited training time, because most police officers and police departments don't have that much training time.
They don't. They don't have it.
Right.
And the other thing is, and I hope I don't sound flip here, but, you know, you got plenty of time. There's no rush to detain somebody that's undetainable, okay? Get more people there. There's the great video of Camden. Like right in the middle of our training, we had this guy start attacking people in a chicken place and running down the street trying to stab people with a knife. And we just, you know, the officers there have been taught to de-escalate it, use space, use tactical distancing to manage the battlefield until the guy runs out of gas. And there's a whole video. I mean, it happened right as I was training them. They did it. And, of course, a bunch of people came back and said, you know, what are you fooling around for? This guy may have turned on you and stabbed one of the officers. You should have shot him. And the chief told me, you know, 2 years ago, we definitely would have shot him. But now we got to save this crazy guy's life, and nobody was hurt, and we still got complaints that we should have shot him. With police officers, your job is to protect this guy. All right? Your job is to protect him, even though you don't like what he did or like what he says or like his attitude. So if you can't submit him, you have to wait. And the other thing I see that's awful is people do not know how to manage their own tactical space. So they get into positions where they get their weapons taken away from them, or they get into positions where they have no alternative but to shoot the guy. Whereas if they just backed off, waited for backup, even if the guy got away temporarily, you know, that's my position. It sounds a little soft, but in the long run, it's safer for everybody, including the officer. Just be more patient, control the battle space, wait for backup. What's the rush? You're going to get overtime anyway.
And especially when you're talking about, you know, essentially misdemeanor. I don't want to use the word chicken shit, but I will. Misdemeanor, yeah. Chicken shit charges. They're non-felonious, right? And so this guy's – and the majority of them are intoxicated or high, mm-hmm. and which, you know, which fuels the escalation. And yeah. So does that guy need to wind up dead? Is it in anybody's interest, from the officer to the, you know, obviously to the victim – it's in nobody's interest for that guy to wind up dead for selling cigarettes, loose cigarettes on the sidewalk, or, you know, falling asleep in a drive-thru at Wendy's. So the juice doesn't, you know, does not in any way, shape, or form equal the squeeze. And so, okay, I just wanted to get your thoughts on that, because to me, we've all watched that. And now these deeper questions about policing across the country, and how we do these things. My first conversations about these things happened with you 3 years ago. And talk to me about, you know, the president spoke today, you know, talking about different, you know, different ways to deal with, for instance, mental health, you know, calls that the police go on, domestic violence calls that the police goes on, the police go on. This is all going to require, you know, funding, you know. So give me your thoughts on that. We're going to have social workers now riding around in police cars, or they're going to be kind of like a canine unit. They're going to be in general support of, you know, of the shift or whatever. Your thoughts on that. If you embrace the guardian role of the police officer, do we need those extra people, that extra payroll?
Well, there's actually a couple of questions in there. So let me back up to the first thing that struck me. The first thing that is necessary and is not being done, I don't think, is this piece about clarifying the self-concept. It's important for Marines. It's important for officers. And if there's a gray area there, if it's not clear, you really don't know who you're going to be under stress. Do you think that that guy woke up that morning saying, you know what I'm going to do today? I'm going to kneel on somebody's neck until they're dead. There's no way that guy thought that that was going to happen when he woke up that morning and shaved himself. No matter what we think about him based upon his past performance, he didn't think that that was going to happen.
Right.
But under stress, what came out? Did the protector come out or did the enforcer come out?
No, the hate came out.
Right. I'm going to make this guy do this. I don't care what I have to do. So if these guys cannot see themselves as protectors, we need to either get them off the street or two, clarify that with them. And there's a process. I can't go through the whole thing, but there's a process that we use to help people to self-discover, are they really a protector? And if they are, is that what drives them every day when they go to work? And is that what's going to come out spontaneously under stress? And I say something like, you know, when you first thought of being a police officer, you're sitting in your high school or your college classroom daydreaming, say, you know what, I want to be a police officer. What were you thinking? What was your dream? What was your fantasy? Was it, I can't wait to get out there and get me a big book of laws and I'm going to go out there and I'm going to enforce those laws? Nobody thought that. They all thought of themselves as, no, I'm going to protect people. I'm going to save people. I'm going to, you know, lock up bad guys so that they can't hurt anybody. And you're not, but over the course of actually becoming a police officer in 3, 4, 5 years of dealing with these people over and over and over again, you kind of lose grip on that initial self-concept and why you wanted to be a police officer or why you wanted to be a Marine for that matter. Because the politics, the stress, dealing with bad people, bad leaders creates, you know, this layer of stress and over, you know, who you really want to be and why you really wanted to be a professional protector. So the first thing we have to do is we have to come up with a way of activating and clarifying that self-concept for these guys. And I told you the other two pieces. Right. Now, when it turns into funding, well, let me tell you something. If there's any police departments listening out there, Camden spent more money on their body cameras. They spent more money on their, you know, what's that system that you can tell where the shots came from?
Right.
You know, triangulating the shot. They spent more money on that than they did on training. Okay? Where did they get the biggest bang for their buck? On the fancy gadgets, on the fancy technology, or on having a police department whose self-concept is that of a protector? I'm arguing that you got a better bang for your buck training your people to be ethical protectors than you did putting cameras on them and you know, other technology and gadgets and shiny new police cars and lights. But shiny new police cars, lights, and gadgets are easy to buy, and you don't have to have full in commitment your heart into it like you have to do with you know, transforming the culture of a police department. I mean, it's cheaper. It just takes more of a commitment than going out and sign a purchase order for a gadget. Whether it's necessary to bring social workers or mental health experts on calls, I think it's not a bad idea to have – this is just my opinion now, okay?
Right.
I have no research to back this up. I don't think that's a bad idea. But, you know, I've met lots of cops, lots of them, who are better psychiatrists than the guy that you pay $250 for sitting on a chair. I mean, they just know more about human nature. They've just seen more things. And they can talk people, you know, the good ones are such good negotiators, and they're so good at dealing with people with mental health issues or Alzheimer's and all of these things that they run into. So I don't think it can hurt, but I think there's so many cops that can do that already that it's not that big of a fix. That
got it.
Yeah.
So if I was to ask you, do you believe that most police departments can get to the place they need to be by embracing the training that you provide, as opposed to saying, okay, the cops aren't going to go on mental health calls anymore. They're not going to go on domestic violence calls anymore. Where would you come down in that discussion of can we raise our level of performance in those areas to the point where we don't need to go down that road if we embrace the concept of, you know, the guardian, you know, police officer?
Mm-hmm. Well, I almost got into it before. I want to talk about a different police department. It's called Toms River, New Jersey. Okay. Now, this Toms River, New Jersey is actually, from my perspective anyway, a better test case. It's a medium-sized police department, so it's not one of these big, gigantic places, but it's not small. They have a lot of cross-cultural issues. They have tourists. You know, this is down where they have the Jersey Shore, that stupid show where all the crazy people come down from New York and right. wreck the place. Right. Lots of fentanyl, lots of drugs passing through from Atlantic City and all this other kind of stuff. The chief there, his name is Mitch Little, and there's news stories on him too. They're not as national as Camden, but locally, there's lots of them. He had the same thing. He had a police department that was not community friendly. There was a lot of trouble. He heard about this program, and he embraced it from the top down. The difference between him and Camden is Camden kind of had a blank slate. You know, they had a new department, a new leader. They could start from scratch. Mitch, well, he had to change the tires on the car while the car was moving. And this is, you know, the road that most departments who would want to enhance their culture or embrace the ethical protector guardian culture are going to have to do it the way Mitch did it. And we trained all of his guys, and he led from the front. And actually, the guy that Joe Wasake Camden had the push-up contest against was the chief of Toms River, Mitch Little. I'm not going to tell you who won, but they
come
both.
Come on, you got to tell us who won.
But I will tell you, I will say this: they both did more than 50 push-ups each in the sand.
But who won?
And boy, oh boy, did that get their local, you know, their own officers behind them 100% because they were leading from the front and taking that chance of being embarrassed. Right. And so Mitch. He's in the paper too. Not only did they have the demonstration, but rather than violence, they used it, the community used it as a way to honor their police department and enhance their community relations. So the answer to your question is you can do it. Anybody can do it, but it's top down, all in. Otherwise, I don't know that you're going to change the culture without all of those pieces. You know, I often use the – and it's when it happens, Mac, it's magic. I mean, I often use, you know, being an Irish guy, you know, like yourself, I often use this analogy. You know, police have all the training. You know, they have de-escalation training. They have use of force training. They have – you know, sensitivity training, cultural training, all this other kind of stuff. Why aren't they all ethical protectors? Answer: you can have malt, you can have yeast, you can have hops, you can have clear running mountain water, you can combine them all in a glass, stir it with a spoon, but you ain't got beer. You got shit. So this magic thing of shared adversity, leadership from the top down, having a mentor culture, that's what takes all those ingredients and changes the culture into this protector culture. having all the disparate parts and throwing them all together and well, I did the training. We had a course. We have it online. That's not going to change the culture. As you know from being a Marine, the best Marine units are the ones that share adversity together, train together, and the leaders lead from the front. Without that, you're really swimming upstream to try to change the culture into what you really think it should be.
You know, I played about a 42-minute clip yesterday of leaders of police unions in New York City venting their spleen last week. And what you heard over and over again was, right, essentially the suits from upstairs that sent us out in the street without a plan have now cut us loose. They didn't have a plan, and, you know, the venom in the air, and it was, I think, four different union leaders and about 200 police officers standing behind them who said, hey, look, you know, we go out there and we preserve the right for you to protest, okay? But, you know, when you send us out there for us to then arrest people, to detain people, and then get told, yeah, we're not prosecuting, and all that did was give criminals a green light, and we paid for it out there. And now we've got cut loose, and the only person being prosecuted from last week is a cop. And so the dissent that came through, right, as you watch that, was phenomenal. Which is, you know, the antithesis of what you're talking about.
Well, I will say this. I hear that constantly. And we also know from the research, Jonathan Shea out of Vietnam, what are the three biggest factors for PTSD? One, stressful stuff that you see and have to do. Granted. Okay. Number two, betrayal by leadership. Number three, dehumanizing the enemy. So you want to know why these cops are stressed? They got all three of those. And by the way, since I'm old now, I will say, Marine Corps, you better watch out for that too. Because my limited exposure to the Marine Corps through the Marine Corps Martial Arts Program and the bureaucracies that surround it, that's all I'll say is we got a lot of people leading by email. A lot of people that really don't know what's going on with the people that they're supposed to be leading and guiding because they're in their offices and they don't know. In my case, they really don't know how important and how valuable the Marine Corps Martial Arts Program could be for the Marine Corps. And if I could just take 15 seconds doing an aside here, Mac, I hope you don't mind.
No.
Right now, the focus down at the Marine Corps Martial Arts Program and Force Fitness is fitness.
Right.
And I'm going to say this straight. We don't need physically fit Marines, okay? We don't need them. What we need is physically fit Marines who can fight, lead, are ethical, and are resilient. So all the money that's going into FFI should be going into MCMAP. Because that's what we need. We don't need physically fit Marines. We need ethical warriors.
And FFI, just for everybody, is Force Fitness Instruction, right? Instructor of that program?
Yeah.
All right. Let me ask you, I want to go back to, it's a mental health question. Mm-hmm. How long can a cop in a large city, medium to large city, how long can somebody be, you know, a police officer before they've seen too much? I mean, to me, I don't know how long you can go fight in wars, but every time you go back, you have less to give and you're more jaded and you've dehumanized the enemy. And you hear that phrase, I know the deal. You don't have to fucking explain it to me. So follow what I do. And younger guys do, because this is the sergeant, right? This is his fourth or fifth deployment. He knows the deal. He's stayed alive. I want to stay alive. And so how long, because in my head I have this concept of a GI Bill for the police officers that, you know, if you're either going to go up or you're going to go out at whatever year at the 8 year mark. If you're not, you know, now a training officer, if you're not a shift commander, if you're not a detective, you know, or whatever in some other form, we cannot afford to keep you as a patrol officer, because, you know, the level of alcoholism, domestic violence, and suicide for you as a group is too high, and we've got, we can't do that anymore. How, your opinion, can somebody do this for on the streets for 20 years?
Well, you know a lot about PTSD. You study it, you talk about it. So forgive me if I kind of oversimplify this. There's two flavors of PTSD. There's the stress of what you've seen, what you've had to do, what you've witnessed. That's one flavor. The other flavor, and sometimes this term is used, is called moral injury. Right. Moral injury is the flavor of PTSD that, because of the stress that's unavoidable for just being a Marine in combat, or just being a Marine in garrison, or a police officer, whether it's in a safe town like Seagirt, where I live, or you know, Camden, if that stress makes you lose your self-concept as a protector, and you do something or some things that you regret, that, you know, that multiplies the stress, right? So there's not too much you can do about the first part. It's part of the job. But the second part, you can do something about that. And the three things that you can do are: don't dehumanize the enemy, have good leadership, and reduce stress by doing physical fitness and having a release program. Now, I've seen officers who are perfectly sane after 20, 30 years, even in New York City. I've seen people burn out in local, yokel, suburban towns in 3 years and eat their gun. What's the deciding factor? Well, of course, the deciding factor is the person himself. What are the outside factors? The outside factors are: what's his self-concept? Does he have good leadership? And is he reducing stress through physical exercise? Is he doing those things? So I really don't have any other opinion than that, because I've seen the whole spectrum. And I really, I'm an outsider. So if you're a real police officer that does it every day and sees it every day, maybe you're too close, or maybe you're even better at understanding the dynamic. But all of us have seen the guy that couldn't last 3 years and the guy that successfully did 30 years. Some of the factors that play into that, you know, is what I just described. So I think that's, not being a real expert on it, I think that's just the best I can contribute to that.
All right. As we end this up, let me, so as you look at, I mean, the nation is focused, like, I don't know that I've ever, any of us have ever seen it before, on police, on policing. Is there any doubt in your mind that the program that, that you've done in not only Camden, but Toms River and whatnot, is there any doubt in your mind that that's the direction that police departments need to go?
Well, it's a direction. I mean, there are other good police departments out there that don't do my program, you know. What I'm a little concerned about is that the ones that I've read about that really do a great job, they may be personality driven. In other words, they just have a good chief, or they just have good officers, and just because of the kind of people they are and the experiences they have and the way they've learned to deal with things, they create a good police department. If those guys weren't there, maybe the police department wouldn't be so good.
And
so,
when they leave, right?
And when they
can
leave,
you sustain
then,
it?
Then the culture is at risk.
Right.
So one thing I can say is, you know, good leadership will probably make a good police department. But if you don't know, if you don't have a process to make your culture, you know, clarified as this guardian culture, and you're a good person and you're willing to go all in, then, you know, what Camden and Toms River did and what we helped them do, you know, that's something maybe that would help you. I'm not selling it, Mac. I'm not here to sell it. Okay. I don't even want to do it again. It's hard.
Right. But, you know? But without embracing the concepts that your program embraces, can you get there? You know,
you can get there if you use all the pieces and you have the magic
leader.
If you have the magic leader and you have that, you know, special sauce, you know, beer has to be, you can have all the ingredients, but if it's not brewed properly,
right.
You know, and you can end up with, you know, Guinness, or you can end up with Miller Lite, you know. So it's really a unique process, and it's going to be different in every police department, and each police department just need a slightly different culture, and right. there's no cookie cutter, you know, train the trainer and you'll get this. Really is a process.
What haven't I been smart enough to ask you about what we've watched as a nation, the direction that departments seem to want to go, this issue, that without which this interview isn't complete?
Well, the most important thing for both McMap and creating a culture is sustainment. With Marines, you have relatively a lot of time to train.
Right.
You know, you and I can complain that too much of it's taken up with, you know, nonsense training. But if you want to, there's plenty of time to do the physical training. There's plenty of time to do the martial arts training. And while you're sitting there sweating after it's done, there's plenty of time to display that leadership and to create the legends and stories that create a good culture. I mean, the Marine Corps is full of hundreds of stories of great ethical Marine warriors. And, you know, you put physical exercise, shared adversity, a little bit of clarification of our self-concept as the defenders of this nature. You tell a couple of the stories, you can get them. Police have a little bit of a different problem. I mean, they don't have that much time to train. What they do have is roll calls. And I have suggested, and I wrote this in the article, and Toms River and Camden in their own way have embraced this. You have to do a sustainment methodology. And the only time that everybody's together almost all the time is at roll call. Roll call is usually used to pass the word.
Right.
But I tell you what, if you take 5 minutes and you go over the de-escalation script, you take 5 minutes and you do deep squats or push-ups, you do 5 minutes of weapons retention, and then you tell a story, either from the news or from your own culture, about an officer that did it right, that we all are proud of and all proud to work with, or that we want to emulate. If you put those pieces into your roll call and you create that sustainment, in the beginning, people will roll their eyes. Oh, why do I have to do 10 push-ups? Why do I have to? My knee hurts. I can't do 10 squats. I know how to reholster my gun. No, you don't know how to reholster your gun. You just saw a video of a guy dropping his frigging gun, okay, because he's under stress, because he hasn't taken it out and reholstered it 100 times a day every roll call for the last 2 years. Believe me, if this guy had done that every roll call for 2 minutes for the last 2 years, he wouldn't have dropped his weapon, I don't think. So I think the piece that's missing is the sustainment methodology. It's just not a one and done. You have a program, everybody goes through it, and then the culture changes. Sustainment is the vital piece that sustains and starts to make the culture accelerate on its own.
And that's a problem, because in order to do more sustainment training, well, I'll tell you what, you just solved the problem. Because
I think I did.
Yeah, you did.
It's worth trying, right?
But what you hear from police departments is, well, in order for us to create more training days, we have to hire more permanent personnel. And that becomes cost prohibitive for us. And so, you know, we're stuck where we're stuck. And I think you just solved that. Jack, I hope you don't mind. I mean, this is now, I mean, a huge story in the country. I hope you don't mind if I bug you on a more frequent basis to come on and comment and make us all smart and explain some of the stuff that we look at and kind of scratch our heads and say, well, why do we do it that way or why don't we do it that way? I hope you don't mind if I bother you here in the future.
Oh, you're never a bother. And, you know, and everybody keep in mind, I fell into this. I'm no big expert at it. I wasn't even a cop. I've never been in combat. I mean, almost everything I learned was from Dr. Humphrey and other leaders that I met in the Marine Corps that had more experience than me. Just the luck of the draw, the weirdness of me being in there when McMap started and me being in there when Camden started. You know, I learned a lot of this stuff just on the fly, but you know, I had that clarified self-concept as a protector, as an ethical warrior from Humphrey. And almost all the things that we came up with and all the things we did came from that. That was the, you know, the X factor. Scott Thompson, the initial chief at Camden, said to me once, Jack, you know, all this training is kind of out there, but you brought the X factor. And I got that X factor from Robert Humphrey.
Wow. Now, it's good stuff. And without the X factor, right, it doesn't make sense. It's just a bunch of techniques, right? It's a bunch of it's a few different ways of doing something.
It ain't beer.
Right. It ain't beer. That's a great, you know what? That is a great analogy. Of, you know, a lot of, you know, having ingredients, but in order for it to be beer, right, you need a brewmaster, and mm-hmm. and your philosophy is certainly that. Thank you for making us smart. And again, I think that if you've been a leader in the Marine Corps, right, we've all served with people of every race, creed, and color, and I'd like to say that for the vast majority of the Marine Corps, you know, we don't see color because of the lessons we learned as Marines and the great people we met, from all walks of life. And then as we see things like this, and especially the misdemeanor stuff that escalates into death, you know, you just, even those that, you know, who've gone, those of us who've gone to Iraq and Afghanistan, you know, you, it's pain. It's so painful. It's like, come on, we got to be better than that. I mean, the guy's asleep in the drive-thru at Wendy's, and now he's dead? Come on. You know, the guy just dropped to the ground. There's four cops. We're not better than that. And look at all the carnage that comes from that. Clearly, the nation's had enough of it. And so I certainly appreciate your words of wisdom. And hopefully we'll see more police departments embracing the concept of being a guardian and the concepts in de-escalation. And we'll see you in a more prominent place nationally. But thank you for doing this.
All right. Well, no charge. Okay, brother. Thank you. And keep going. I'm proud of you. What you're doing is wonderful. And it's your dream. So you're following it. And people should take that as inspiration.
Well, you said something in your remarks about talking to a police officer is most of the time much better than, you know, talking to a licensed therapist because of their life experience and the fact that they deal with it more. And my experience with, you know, what I now call post-traumatic winning is simply the amalgamation of all the different things I've learned from people like you and others that have come on this radio show and have shared their experiences. And so even the stupid of us, after sitting here for 4 years listening to it, you know, you can gather those lessons and say, these are the things that 90% of the people that have lived great lives with traumatic events in them tell me that you have to do. So I'm just telling you that you've got to – they've told me this. I'm telling you this, that if you do these things, you can go where they go. And so very similar to what you said. So I appreciate your words, though. And for me, this has been incredibly life-changing. And being able to help people, and I'm doing more and more with law enforcement now, these concepts of you're not going to get over it. You've got to learn to live a disciplined life. If you don't, you know, if you don't stay physically fit, which is good for your brain, if you don't restrain your alcohol consumption, if you don't learn to manage your money well, you're going to get on a road that's well traveled, and it's not a good one, and it doesn't lead you to a good place. But if you aren't afraid to live a disciplined life, if you aren't afraid to learn to coexist with your trauma, and if you do commit to giving the wisdom that you get from this program to other people, watch what happens to your life. It'll transform your life. And so it's been life-changing, but thank you very much. I appreciate it.
Okay. 7 for 5, brother.
There you have it. Jack Hoban. More Ballroom Radio coming up next right here on your home for it, the All Warrior Radio Network.